This is Recovery Radio, the first radio show in Rhode Island to offer useful information for the purpose of helping men and women suffering from alcohol, drug, and other addictions. Recovery Radio's goal is to raise awareness about the services and organizations available in the state dedicated to improving the outcome of those with addictions. Recovery Radio, hosted by John Tassoni and presented by Phoenix Houses of New England. Call John now at 437-5000 or 888-345-0790. Now, here's John Tassoni.
Welcome to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, John Tassoni. Damp, dreary Monday. But we got one hell of a guest today. Dr. Skip is in the house again. Doc, welcome and thank you for joining us today.
It's great to be back, John.
Let's talk about a couple of things that have been percolating in the state. Number one, I got some news today pertaining to the warm line that the state is running pertaining to overdoses. Last week was their biggest week with phone calls. We're getting near the holiday season. Some people are stressed because of it.
Mm-hmm.
They want to probably put their stresses to rest. But now I think the next 3 or 4 weeks, I think we'll be hitting a high on overdoses, and which is disturbing. That's one of the things I wanted to talk about today. And the second thing is, what BHDDH has come up with is the Center of Excellence.
Right.
So let's talk about the Center of Excellence first, and then we'll talk about the overdoses afterwards.
Well, I think the Center of Excellence is a terrific idea. It is now fully running at the Kodak Recovery Centers, and there are about 6 locations around the state where they are located. The Centers of Excellence, at least from the physician's point of view, have been set up to help doctors who are primary care doctors or other specialties, not addiction medicine, but who are a little reluctant to get into treating patients with opiates because it's a little different kettle of fish from their regular patients. Mm. And there are many doctors who do have the appropriate number to prescribe Suboxone, which I'm a huge fan of. I really think it's the best way to go. They find that they're either too busy to get started, or they don't really feel comfortable getting started in talking to the patients about their addiction. And so the BDDH has formulated these ideas, which will allow doctors who are in primary care groups who do want to get involved and take care of their patients, send people over to the Centers of Excellence to be evaluated for their addiction, see what the appropriate level of care is, whether they sometimes need admission, sometimes need intensive outpatient, which will all be provided at the Center of Excellence, or just set them up for regular counseling depending upon which drug they're addicted to, and by and large, mostly to opiates. And then once they've stabilized the patient and get them really on a dose of Suboxone that seems appropriate, gets them in pretty good shape, sends them back to the doctors, who can then integrate them into their regular office and take care of them. If the doctor in the first couple of times is a little concerned about dirty urine screens, which might pop up, or any of the things that routinely happen, he can refer back to the Center of Excellence. And so it's a good place for him or her to get some advice in how to daily treat patients who are basically in their practice. They want to start out with patients who are primarily in their practice till they get a good feel for it, who need addiction help. Mm. So it's a good idea. It's up and running at Kodak, and the two primary care medical groups that have agreed to try this out, along with the BDDH and Dr. Alexander Scott, the director of the Department of Health. I think she's a wonderful director and doing a very good job. Our Coastal Medical and University Medical, and they're making it very easy. They're joining something which not all of their physicians want to be interested in, but they take the ones who are eager to help their patients or get involved in addiction medicine, make it easy for them without them having to become specialists.
Mm. Let me ask you this question about, You know, the primary care docs. I've had conversations with a number of them, and to be honest, it hasn't gone well, because of a stigma issue.
Right.
Being that, you know, I don't want to take care of those type of people, or this population is not the one that I want to deal with. And one of the ones that I belong to, that I go to, is Coastal Medical.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it ironic now that they have, I use the word, see the light,
mm-hmm.
in coming into the Center for Excellence. Because when I had that conversation with them, and I brought to the brochures, and we talked about it, and we talked about people coming in, and they, at that point, they didn't think it was a good idea for their organization to be involved. So what do you think made or suggested to them that this would be a good thing to do? I mean, I think any medical doctor who sees a patient, their patients, who have issues with substance abuse, should be looked at with someone who has knowledge of substance abuse to get them help, instead of just being cast aside and stigmatized, saying, sorry, we can't help you.
Yeah, I think they've the death rate, number one,
right.
can't be ignored. The pressure on the doctors to be more responsible in their prescribing, I think has had some peers looking at each other and thinking, you know, maybe we should rethink this. I think the real problem, if they happen to identify a patient that they might think is using, they find that if they get into those issues, and I have spoken to a bunch who've actually started to treat their patients, and they see another side of the patients, whether their patients were using licit opioids that they happened to start with that doctor, but then because these doctors are really pretty good, they're not the big script writers, they've gone out doctor shopping, but they kept their doctor, but they're going around to get other ones. They don't know what to do with these patients.
Yeah.
And I can tell you from my point of view, I'm lucky in one way, having been a terrible addict and alcoholic, and still am technically. But every doctor that I've ever known in the past wants to go into medicine to help patients. And one of the basic tenets that you help your patient with is the truth. And so everything is based, you have a new patient come in, he's got a sore shoulder, you're an orthopedic surgeon, you're assuming the guy's telling you the truth as he sees it. You do your testing, you evaluate him, you look at it, you make a plan, you try some therapy, and you expect the patient to give you a truthful answer. Now, you can see whether the shoulder's improving or not, but
right.
It's based on truth. Completely different in people who have gone over to the side of opioid dependence, and to use the correct terminology for addiction, have really gone illegal, have decided to get opiates despite adverse consequences. So they're coming in with months or years of not telling the truth to anybody. So a doctor who's been used to taking care of someone who basically tells them, it's not every patient tells the truth,
right.
But the basis is gone. And now, even if the patient's eager to get help, they're ashamed, they don't know what to say, or they're not ready to stop, and they just see another doctor that might be able to help them. So it's an adversarial relationship. And it's pretty easy to take care of, but you got to change your whole way of speaking to your patient. And I do think that turns a lot of doctors off. And I've said that to them in groups. You know, you basically can't trust these people until you get to know them,
right.
And you have proof. So I think they've avoided it because any experience they've had in dealing with it, they might feel a little guilty about having been part of it, but that's not the main reason. I think the main reason is they got a tiger by the tail and they don't know what to do.
All right, I got a tiger by the tail too. We got to take a break. You're listening to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, John Tassone. We'll be right back. Phoenix Health of New England, a national nonprofit leader in the treatment of substance use disorders and co-occurring behavioral health issues. Phoenix Health provides comprehensive care for medically monitored withdrawal, available in Rhode Island, our new facility in Quincy, Massachusetts, to residential and outpatient treatment and recovery housing for adults. For teens, we offer both intensive patient out treatment and comprehensive outpatient services. At Phoenix, our highly professional staff is committed to helping you achieve a better way of life through recovery. Major insurance plans and credit cards are accepted, and a sliding fee scale is available. So give us a call at 1-800-DRUG-HELP. That's 1-800-378-4435, or go online and visit us at phoenixhouse.org. Take your first step to the path to recovery today. Call Phoenix House, accredited by the CARF, the Commission on Accreditation and Rehabilitation Facilities, is a national standard of excellence. Phoenix House of New England is a proud sponsor of Recovery Radio. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Sean Tassone. In the studio today, the world-renowned Dr. Skip is in the house. Welcome, Doc, and thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about urine screens, fentanyl. There seems to be a rash of fentanyl hitting the streets in Rhode Island. So let's talk about urine screens. If, in fact, say I go to my primary care physician and he says, John, I think it's time for you to take a urine test.
Right.
Take a blood test. If I was taking opiates, would it show up in my urine even though he didn't ask for it to be looked at?
No.
No.
No. You know, a urine test is primarily for kidney, some other functions in your blood, how your kidneys are working. But if you're not told that it's a urine screen for drugs, which you should be, you will not. It will not show up because they don't test for it. They need certain chemicals to test for it.
Right. So when someone asks a question of, well, they should have picked up on it because they took a urine test. That's a false statement.
Exactly. If you're not taking a urine test for drugs, it won't show up at all.
Hmm. Well, what about this fentanyl? I mean, fentanyl has hit Rhode Island like. A 1-2 punch from Muhammad Ali.
Absolutely right. And float like a butterfly and
sting like a bee.
Like a bee.
A hornet.
You got it. Yes, there's a lot of fentanyl coming in. I'm fortunate to be involved with some of these meetings with the governor. They had a couple of DEA agents recently talk about the fentanyl coming from China. It's being made in a couple of cities in China, and the powder is being shipped across to the West Coast, Vancouver, L.A., Baja, and being shipped across the country, and the vast majority of it's coming up to the New England area, and Rhode Island certainly is in the path. A couple of scary things about it, the fentanyl is, in its production, it's either 20, 30, or 50 times more powerful than morphine, which is actually what heroin is. Heroin's a couple of morphine molecules linked together. But the morphine molecule as a basis of the unit of strength, this can be 50 times as strong molecule for molecule. In some places, it's used as an elephant tranquilizer for real.
Really?
Yeah. And I should have brought with you, there's a picture in one of the journals recently to show the equivalence of how much heroin is the equivalent of fentanyl that is 20, 30, or 50 times. It's remarkable.
I would like you to send that to me.
I will do that. And so what you say, well, how are they getting it? Fentanyl has been around, and it's quite a good painkiller in the hospital. 4 or 5 years ago, I mean, it comes in oral form, but it was distributed to patients as an outpatient or postoperatively in patches. And the first problem really popped up with, it's phased in as a time release in the fentanyl patch that you put in your arm. But anybody who's an addict wants to get the high faster, just like with OxyContin.
Right.
So they used to either scrape the fentanyl off and eat it, frankly, to get it all together. That was very common. So you wouldn't see fentanyl that often because you had to get a dealer who knew how to get legitimate fentanyl. It's not the case anymore, both at Phoenix House and in my office. When I have people coming in who are using heroin, it's rare that I get a test back that shows just the heroin, and for that matter, just cocaine. We do very extensive urine tests, but even our urine tests, we had to add fentanyl to a couple of years ago, because if you're not testing specifically for a bunch of drugs, there's no assay for all drugs. So
right,
you have
right.
to look specifically for it. And so now, it's amazing. Some of the people are coming into detox, for example, at Phoenix House. They're coming in scared. These are old heroin addicts who have been doing it a long time because they've been burying friends because the fentanyl is getting out there and it's so strong that people really are coming in asking, see, I don't want to die. It's been that brutal. Guys that know how to do their heroin, It sounds silly, but I mean, they're old timers. They've been living a long time with it. They're getting a little nervous because even if they don't ask for the fentanyl, it's being put in their heroin to make it higher kick. And it's so cheap, the markup on it, according to the DEA guys, is way over markup on heroin, the production of heroin. Another thing that's being done is they showed pictures of fentanyl actually being made into fake Oxy 30 pills. So oxycodone 30 is one of the stronger pills that a lot of people snort or swallow, but usually snort or chew to get high. Oxycodone is very strong. But they're now putting fentanyl in, and they have their own pill presses. They showed these pills, which are hard to distinguish, and you can make it with a very little amount of drug and a lot of filler. So people, but you're not getting somebody measuring it with DEA standards, so you end up dying. So people are going to get it. In fact, Prince, when the singer Prince died about it, I don't know, a year ago now, they found that the pills in his house were pure fentanyl, were labeled Oxy. So that was a forerunner. I kind of knew when I heard what happened to him very quickly, the first time his plane landed, that he was doing drugs and that they were giving him, you know, Narcan and stuff. But it turns out that he died with an enormous fentanyl overdose. And the fentanyl was in pills that were made by the dealers that looked like Oxy-30. So even people who think, well, that's not going to bother me anymore, some of the pills you're buying on the street might be Oxy-30s. No, they're going to be fentanyl, and you have no idea how much fentanyl is in there. So people are dying. That's why the death rate continues to climb in spite of the fact that opioid prescriptions are coming down. So you have to test for fentanyl if you're involved with people who are in drug, because whether they know it or not, and a lot of them go ask for some fentanyl, but that's double dangerous. But each drug has to be tested for specifically. In the old days, most opiates were made from the poppy plant, that the opioids, synthetic opiates like Vicodin and oxycodone. In the old days, if you were tested for opiates and somebody was stoned on Vicodin, it wouldn't show up unless you asked for Vicodin. Mm. So urine drug screens come a long way. Mm. So if you're just going to your doctor for something else and you're getting, and he wants to do a urine test for your physical, unless he lets you know that it's a drug screen there too, it won't come up.
Mm. So I want to get back to the fentanyl pill.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
What type of effects does that pill have compared to an OxyContin pill? Is it more, obviously it's more potent.
Yeah, right.
But, I mean, what kind of effects?
You get a lot of energy, but you do tend to nod off some more. There's more, a little bit more sedation because of the enormous climb over the regular. People who are taking oxycodone or Vicodin or even, you know, heroin, they don't get sleepy unless they're massively overdosing. So, you know, people coming out of recovery who have dropped their tolerance because they have been clean for a week or 10 days, they used to be able to take 2 grams. Now they're going to try to take 1 gram. They're at great danger because you lose your tolerance quickly. So taking a fentanyl pill when you're used to taking that you think is Oxy, just like doubling, tripling, or quadrupling it, so you can pass out, and you're definitely you'll get energized, but you may be so energized that you become somewhat sedated.
So is it energized, and then your blood pressure drops?
No.
To go to sleep?
No. If you take enough, your blood pressure will drop because all opiates dilate your arteries. Okay, so if you're dry, if you take enough, part of your problem is that you'll fall down, you'll lose your blood pressure. I mean, you can faint, you can die, yes. But the sedation isn't just for blood pressure drop. The sedation is that your receptors are being bombarded with a lot more than you normally have, and that gets you sleepier and more confused. Mm. People who bring up their opiates slowly, really it's very hard to tell for people if they don't know addiction, someone who's just on opiates. Quite different when you add diazepine like Valium and stuff, or if you add alcohol. People then get confused. You can smell it. But if you've been slowly bringing up your opiates, you might think something's wrong with the patient, but with the person you're looking at, but you can't tell. But if they've just quadrupled or quintupled their dose with one pill, they're not going to be in control of it, and so they're going to look a little bit more confused, a little bit more dazed, and they may be hyper, but they're going to drop eventually.
As far as the fentanyl and the testing for fentanyl,
right?
How long does it stay in your body in order to be picked up by A, urine screen, B, a hair follicle, or...
Yeah, hair follicles, it'll stay a while, a long time. Urine screens, all opiates of any kind are usually gone between 2 and 4 days from your body, okay? We're finding it's an interesting question because although it should clear in the same amount of time as heroin, regardless of how much you've been taking, it should be within that 2 to 4 day window. To go on Suboxone, you must go into withdrawal. And it's kind of interesting, and it's an off topic now. But if you're using Vicodin or if you're using heroin, which is primarily morphine, then you need to be in 24 hours of withdrawal, and then you can take Suboxone and feel better right away. Oxycodone is 36 hours. You've got to be off oxycodone 36 hours. If you're on methadone, on a low dose of methadone, and you want to go on Suboxone, you need to wait 48 hours. But I'm finding empirically, and they're not writing about this now, but I've had several patients who were doing a lot of fentanyl, and they need to be off it for like 2.5 to 3 days. So it's really staying in the body and actively working longer. The only reason I mentioned Suboxone is that's a good way to tell how much it's affecting you and how long. So the fentanyl, I think, is staying in longer. And to try to put someone on Suboxone, I'm now making them wait longer than they want. They feel better at 2 days. Right? Yeah.
I got a lot more questions about that, but we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Sean Tassone. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Sean Tassone. In the studio today is Dr. Skip. If you want to read a book, From Harvard to Hell and Back, Dr. Skip is the true author of that book. And welcome, Doctor, and thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure, sir.
I want to talk just a little bit about the book.
Yep.
And then we'll get back into our discussion of overdoses. The book that you wrote is very much a book that, and I'm not a reader. But like the Vinny Paz movie, a guy that breaks his neck and comes back and becomes a champion. Your book should be the sequel to the Vinny Paz movie because you were a champion. You got broken and you came back.
Well, I was fortunate. Yes, I did. I was able to with the help of my family. Yep.
So, you know, this radio program that I do every Monday, I look at it to the point where I'm trying to get information out so people can really understand the issue of abuse, substance abuse. Hopefully the information gets out to families. And I said this, and I was doing a little bit of training, 12 days for the state police about substance abuse. And this is not a issue of inner city kids anymore. This is an issue of doctors, nurses, executives, police officers, firefighters. This is not an issue of low-income people. It's sees no boundaries here.
Right.
Substance abuse. Whether it be alcohol or pills.
Right.
Or needles or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things, too, that I did an op-ed, and I'm waiting for it to be published from the Providence Journal pertaining to substance abuse. As you know, I mean, I have no background in it other than I want to do the right thing for people. I'm not in recovery, never was in recovery. I maybe have one beer a month or something like that. I don't smoke. But I see what it does to families, and I see what it does to human beings. And I want to get back to the issue of stigma. And the issue of stigma really bothers me because in my op-ed, I say that if it's an epidemic of a hot issue or diabetes and we're losing 200-300 people out of whack, then the government would step in and say, we got an epidemic here. Well, we have an epidemic now. But I don't believe that we're doing enough to cultivate the epidemic as far as we're short on rooms. We have no more adolescent programs here in Rhode Island because of funding.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has to be shipped out of state now, and I don't think that's good for the families. So give me your 6,000-foot bird's-eye view of what someone who has been there, done that, how we can make this better.
Well, the numbers are coming in now that medical-assisted treatment really help people. And I do believe that the vast majority of my patients can be treated as outpatients. But that's kind of a narrow view. Those are people who have had the wherewithal to call the office, wait for an appointment, come in and do all that stuff. So I'm looking at sort of the middle group of people that I see. The medications that are out there will help people by transferring their addiction from the bad stuff to other addicting stuff, and in my view, to Suboxone. I think that not everyone needs rooms, but we certainly need more rooms for people who are multi-drug users. Although far and away in the last couple of years, people are primarily opiate users. In fact, the opiate disease grabs them up, so they're really not doing anything else. They have to spend all their time and all their money and all their crimes and everything just to get more opiate. And I mean, it really is the king addictor. And that's why after you get people off of opiates and get them, you really do need to work on some of the other stuff so people don't slide off. But my view is that people are aware of it. It's very slow. I have to say that Dr. Alexander Scott's doing a hell of a job and addressing this. The governor's overdose council, overdose prevention task force, which I go to once a month and see you there, is in the right direction. It's not. There are a lot of dedicated people. I mean, it's amazing how dedicated and how knowledgeable you are about this without ever having addiction for you or your immediate family. But you know, we need more people like you, obviously. But it's not killing as many people as heart disease and cancer yet, but it's getting there. Mm. It just surpassed accidents and and gunshot wounds.
Right.
So it's on the way up. So you're right, the stigma scares people away. In regard to the personal stigma that I have, because my story is one where I had everything given to me, and there wasn't much stigma attached to me because I was starting to fade and use and hiding it from everybody. But boy, the minute I lost my license for self-prescribing, the stigma attached, and he's a bad doctor. We don't ever want to see him again. So I've been on both sides of it. But I earned that. I did that myself. And so I wanted to get the stigma off. But I have seen so many people who now come to my office are productive citizens. And they're not just surviving. They're thriving. They're enjoying their lives.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by
well,
that?
Well, I mean for my house buying example is amazing. I've had 8 different people since April now. And I say this everywhere I go because I've had people a couple times a year end up buying a house. But I did notice that the first week of April this year, 2 different patients came in. They both talked about buying their first house. They were in their early 40s, those first two. We're not related, completely unrelated. They were all IV or snorting heroin users. They had never owned a house before. But by getting into treatment, by getting a job, by saving some money, usually they come in and tell me they bought their first car in 20 years or their first car ever, and then they'll admit to me it's a secondhand car. Well, that's fine. And then the next time it's a new one, and then it's a house. But since April through December the 12th, 8 people total have actually gone from being heroin users out in the street with no previous history of owning a house to owning a house and having a family and bringing me in the paperwork from the signing or bringing me in pictures of the kids in front of the house. So this illness can be fixed and can be turned around, and you can never forget that you're an addict, because it's ridiculous to think that you can't do it again. But on the other hand, you develop so much, so many good things around you that it's really hard to go use again. So I think that in that category. Now, the desperate, the one thing that I don't know how to fix, John, is how to give people an aim in life. If they're aimless and they've been used to going in and out of all the detoxes, you got to somehow say, listen, you got a talent. We got to find it somewhere, because most human beings do. Because just being in detox and getting out and thinking, I'll try for a while, but if I fail, I'll just go back in. Mm. It's not fun in there, but at least it's not horrible. It's not as horrible as being in the street.
Right. And it's so, almost like a roller coaster.
It is a roller coaster.
You got to give them an avenue to be productive.
Exactly.
Be productive.
Exactly. New England Tech, I mean, all kinds of areas to go to. Mm. And, I mean, these people who bought the houses clearly had jobs, got jobs, did something. But if you don't have a name in life, we need to get some help in that area.
Right. Yeah. We're going to take another quick break. Listen to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Sean Tassone. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Sean Tassone. Dr. Skip is in the house. Doc, thank you for joining us from Harvard to hell and back. I love it. I love it. Let me ask you this question. I don't think I've ever asked you, and the amount of times that you've been on the show, where the hell did you get that name?
I made it up.
Really?
Yeah. It's funny because I made it up and the publisher was going to use it. And when we went to file it, it turned out somebody had already used it.
All
not
right.
About drugs. So we had to put in the subtitle, Doctor's Journey from Recovery, from Addiction Through Recovery. Mm. But somebody used it about an experience he had. And his book was out of print and it was old, so it was legal for us to do it. But I was annoyed that somebody else had thought of it, because I never had anything go wrong with me when I was at Harvard. I was really having a good time. I mean, clearly my life was not headed in the best direction, but everything came easy to me. And next thing you know, from my perspective, even though I was 52, I'm sitting in hell. Like, how did this happen? Hmm. And I know I made it happen. I'm not blaming anybody.
Yeah, right.
And it just seemed right to me. And getting back was the day I realized that I was an addict and an alcoholic. And That's simple. I'll just stop. I mean, it sounds stupid now, but that day was back because I didn't feel well for a couple of weeks, but my head started to clear. I started to get better, and things I had really ruined them so much financially and with all my relationships with everybody. It was still a long haul, but I was sure that day that it wasn't going to. So that was my climb back, and I'm back is wonderful.
Mm.
Yeah, and I can't tell you how I love to encourage my patients to enjoy the damn recovery. See, when we're using and we see a nice family walking down the street around Christmas, and we're sick ourselves, we think, I don't want that. I mean, that's boring. At least that's what I thought.
Yeah, right,
believe
me,
I
got
a lot of patients who believe that.
Yeah.
And that was just nothing but mega denial. And now in this Christmas time, as people come in to see me and get their Suboxone, most of them a lot less than they used to be on, I'll say, as they'll talk about the stress of Christmas, I'll say whether stress is good or stress is bad. I mean, all holidays cause stress. The bad ones are behind us, hopefully. But even a good holiday is stressful. And I will say to them, you know, isn't it wonderful that you don't have to worry about, especially if you're going to go away for a day or two to see a family member, that you don't have to worry about, do you have enough dope to survive the next couple of days and pretend you're having a good time? And they all laugh at that because you're trying to pretend that everything's okay. It's the worst time to be an active addict. And you're right. Suicides will go up. Deaths, overdoses will go up, whether suicides are accidental for those who can't make it through. So it's a bad time. But they'll all sit and laugh at me and say, God, I felt the same way as you did. And these are people with completely different backgrounds. And we love to laugh together about it. You just don't have to worry about using this Christmas.
Suboxone. Let me ask you this question about Suboxone. Age.
Yep.
Can someone who's 17, 18 go on Suboxone.
18, yes. 17, you need parental consent, or if it's an emancipated minor. But you usually want to get some kind of parental consent for 17. I'm sure there are ways that you can help somebody who's an extremist.
Right, right, right.
But technically, they should be 18.
What about your oldest client?
My oldest client was doing well when he came to see me. He's been around. He's my third patient in 2008 when I opened. He's down to one-third of the dose of Suboxone that he was on. We've come down over the last 8 years. And he just likes the safety net there. He's not impaired. He actually didn't lose everything to the drug. Patients number one and number two went off in different areas. He's just a wonderful guy. And I just see him regularly. We chat, we laugh, and he's on his way. He looks at his medication, because right now there's been no long-term problems with Suboxone yet that have been described. And although it's only been around about 10 years sublingually, that is in the mouth, it's been around another 20 years intravenously. So there's a very good safety profile on the long-term use. The argument that it's a drug that you got to get off eventually and it's just one substitution over the other, I think, is false. You don't get high on the drug. It just gets you even. But my very first patient, we just laugh together. We look at his number, and I'm reminded once a month that there he is.
What about the average age of your patients?
It's in the early 30s.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and we've got him as old as 70.
More male than female? More female?
Yeah, but about 60-40, 65-35, I think was that last count, male and female. But more and more women are coming in.
You know, in doing the seminars for the troopers, we got some information back from Colorado. They've done this big study pertaining to women that are pregnant, that are having the babies, and I think it might have also came out of the Netherlands back a few years ago, that the average birth weight for a infant that's born is almost close to a pound less when they're using than when they are not using. How does fentanyl work in an infant's body other than, you know, obviously they're going to be addicted to whatever they're using, but has there been any studies of what fentanyl has done to?
No, opiate addicted babies. I haven't seen any with recent studies that's specifically opiate versus heroin, so I don't know the answer to that, and I doubt it's been this massive over usage hadn't been around long enough. People who are maintained on either methadone or Suboxone while they're pregnant, they actually, the birth weight of their babies is about the same as long as they use no other drugs.
Right.
All bets are off if you're using anything else. The birth weight and the Apgars and all the indication of that if you are pregnant and you're using, you should stay on treatment.
All right, Dr. Skip, want to thank you very much for coming on today. Always a pleasure to have you.
Good to see you.
Come back after January with some of your clients who bought those houses. It'd be great. Happy holidays to you and your family.
Merry Christmas, sir. Thank you.
You're listening to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Sean Tassone. See you next week. It's gonna be